This podcast is brought to you by Underwriters Laboratory, Workplace Health and Safety.
So the first title we're going to release is more informational for organizations, and it's really designed to help educate the entire population related to the new view of safety. So we get into looking at how the best-in-class organizations are utilizing these techniques to drive improvement, but ultimately set up the rest of the content that will be coming online at the end of the first quarter. This first module will be available for free, and we'll announce soon when you're able to access that content as well as where. Thank you.
All of this cool stuff's available at Underwriters Laboratory, workplacehealthandsafety.com. Think about it, you guys. They're great sponsors, and thank you for doing that. And now, let's get on with the podcast.
That is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's super simple. I mean, there's nothing to it.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm your loving host, Todd Conklin. How's it going, man? How is life happening for you? Now we are in the fabulous month of April. It is April. Can you believe it? I cannot believe it. We're a quarter through the year. Where did this go? What happened? I was just hanging out, and then, crap, look, it just went away. Everything good with you? I'm pretty crazy here. Do I have new news? I don't think I have much new news. The podcast numbers are nutball. Thank you very much for listening. It's all about you, too. I actually totally dig this time. It's really funny. I really like the idea of sitting down and talking, sort of cutting the little introduction part of the podcast and trying to think about, what is interesting to talk about this time? I think that's really fun and interesting, and I love the feedback I get from you guys. What a great group of people we have. And so many people are so interested in, like today's podcast is a really good example of that. I get a lot of feedback that we don't talk enough about investigations. Have investigators talk about investigations. And I always call all these investigators, but investigators are a really interesting group of people because generally speaking, I can't get them to be on the podcast. They just don't want to do it. But I try to talk to people I can, and actually today I talked to, you know, a great investigator, and we talk a lot about investigations, and it's interesting to me that that part is such a demand, a pull on the podcast, and then I think about it, and it makes total sense. I mean, the one way to quickly change an organization is to change the way the organization does investigations, and I think we really struggle with the right way. I made little quotes in the air when I said that, the right way to investigate. In fact, I'm not sure there is a right way to investigate. I think it's how we think about investigating that actually sets our investigations up to be successful. And that's a big part of, I guess, everything. I mean, it's how you look at stuff that really colors what you find. Right? I mean, you can call that a bunch of stuff, the Heisenberg effect or the Hawthorne effect or confirmation bias or whatever fancy pants monkey man word you want to use for that. But it's really all about sort of where's our worldview. And one of the challenges I think is really interesting is that organizationally, oftentimes I find places that can't really tell me why they investigate. So why do you do investigations? Well, the answer is really simple: to learn and improve. I mean, if it's anything other than learn and improve, you probably got the wrong answer. They certainly don't establish culpability. Hell, we know who screwed up. That's not a big deal. They don't really determine facts, although facts are sexy and very attractive. You know, they're just a matter of perspective, right? That's what dictates the fact. What they do is they help us explain, tell the story, understand, and learn and improve. And that's really what it's about. That's the whole thing. My life is grand, of course. The year of going slow is a huge failure. Just a big flipping failure. F for failure. I cannot believe my whole goal was to slow down and just kind of take it easy, barbecue more, hang out, you know, do stuff with none of it's happening. I'm busier than can be. And I'm not complaining. It's not my complaining voice. It's just my goal was to kind of, you know, leave some big gaps in the calendar and just kind of hang out. And I suck at it. I'm terrible at it. It's hideous. But in the long run, it's kind of good because, you know, I get to see people like you guys. And everybody's getting so good at this. I mean, It's the improvement. It's exciting to watch everything happen. So without any further ado, let's go into the podcast. It's probably time to listen to it anyway. So today's Ivan Popoliti. Ivan's with the Forest Service. I actually had him introduce himself because I didn't really – I know him very, very well. I didn't even really know what his new title was. So Ivan's going to introduce himself, and he's going to talk us through sort of how he's thinking about stacking investigations. As opposed to sort of high, medium, low, or, you know, small event, large event, high consequence, low consequence, he's going to talk a little bit about the difference between simple, complicated, and complex. I really like this idea. Listen carefully to this podcast. I think you're going to like it. So without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please buckle your seatbelts. This is Ivan Popoliti, the Pupster, and we're going to talk about learning. Peace.
Well, I probably ought to introduce myself, which I never seem to be able to do on these podcasts. So so let me start off with I'm the director of the Office of Innovation and Organizational Learning and Human Performance for the U.S. Forest Service. Yeah.
That sounds fancy.
Sounds fancy. Hard to get on a business card.
Just get a bigger business card.
There you go. Get the wraparound business card.
Yeah. Or like an iPad-sized business
card.
Yeah,
there you go. Well, it's probably going to digital business cards. Who knows?
I wonder. Yeah, I bet you're right, actually. I bet that will happen. You can probably, like some phones, you can just tap them, right?
Yep.
And pass all that information across. So that's easy.
But I ought to talk a little bit about what I do.
That's a cool title.
Yeah, so human performance, I just picked that group up here recently, and the human performance group is into individual resilience. So they're looking at ways that people can look at health and wellness, comprehensive health and wellness, personal well-being. They're actually certified trainers, certified coaches and counselors. We send them through the Duke coaching program.
Right.
Awesome program, and some of them have stepped even further into working at Harvard in their coaching programs,
right,
and developed some additional skills. And now we're trying to figure out right now, and in fact, we're trying to figure out how we can export that to the Forest Service. So we can't obviously have two or three people who are trained in this teach everybody in the Forest Service about comprehensive wellness. Can't be done. So what we're doing instead is trying to figure out ways to develop local folks as what they're calling champions. Their title for them is champions, so local champions, where we will identify these local champions, give them additional courses, bring them up to a certain level of expertise, and then have them as the local people to help everybody in the local unit. So the way the Forest Service is divided is we've got regions.
Right.
And the regions are divided into forests, and the forests are divided into districts.
Not trees?
Not trees.
Dang it. That'd have been perfect.
Yeah, well, it kind of makes it interesting for us to try and find the forest from the trees.
Yeah, exactly. Right? That's where I was going with that, yeah.
But the neat part about the champion idea is that we could have people at even the district level that are identified as local experts in comprehensive wellness. And it's kind of a neat idea.
So you're really looking at whole worker, right?
Whole worker health.
I like this idea of individual resilience. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so this is something that kind of grew out of a dialogue. We were trying to define what resilience was. Nearest we could tell, resilience had a lot to do with learning. We couldn't differentiate between the two. Learning, safety, and resilience seemed to tie into this interesting little triangle or triad. And as we started to look at it, we started thinking, well, the organization has certain responsibilities around these things, these three areas, and the individual has certain responsibilities and abilities around these three areas. And so what we recognized is if we could work with them to develop their individual awareness abilities around how to make themselves more fit, ready for duty, go for their total worker health concepts. So we started partnering with NIOSH for total worker health. We started partnering with, like I said, Duke University for counseling and coaching. And we started looking at programs like the Human Performance Institute, started by Jim Lohr in Florida, for a program that they have, which is great for individual well-being. So instead of managing time, they're thinking about managing themselves in time and space. And it's a dietary program, exercise program, again, designed around total worker health. And so if you think about us, I mean, what we do in the Forest Service, we're looking at firefighters, we're looking at people who mark trees, timber cruisers, we're looking at people that do trail work. We've got a lot of outdoor activities that work in a very, very different environment than most workers do, and a very, in many cases, very diverse environment. So the folks that we have working in the field have a certain set of demands on them. Well, the people that work in the office have a certain set of demands on them as well. And so when we start to talk about total worker health, we're trying to find programs that'll balance for both of these groups.
How did you train leadership to get through this? Because it seems like it's a whole different expectation on the leaders.
It's a great program. And you kind of know the answer to this because you were in on the first phase of this. In fact, we started a safety journey for our leadership. How long ago was that, Todd?
I mean, I was trying to think maybe, I don't know.
It was over 10 years ago.
That was it really?
This. Yeah. Were still at Los Alamos.
I was young, not beaten down by the man.
Exactly.
I still had my looks.
You still have your looks.
Huh, thanks,
you got that.
Thanks.
So we started actually our first safety journey. Our first visit was to you at Los Alamos, and we brought our senior leaders out of the head shed and out of the regional offices, and we brought them out to the field to see how other organizations were doing things that were labeled as safety. They went to UPS, they went to the Coast Guard, Los Alamos. They did some work with Con Edison, a couple of construction companies in the central part of the United States. So they got a pretty good flavor of what's happening in the industry. And what that did was that put them in a really interesting mode. And I think that this is the key. The key is to put leadership in a mode of inquiry. If they're inquiring, if they're asking questions, you've got them, because that's when they start to learn. If you can't get them into that place where they're starting to ask questions, then they're going to be in a place of knowing, and they're going to be more dictatorial.
Right.
So as soon as they did that, it was transformative inside the organization, literally transformative, in that leadership began to ask questions. Well, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do, and their belief is that they have to create safety. But that, once they started asking questions, we got them to understand that safety is created in a multitude of places in the organization. Sure, leadership has a role in it, but the field has a tremendous role in the creation of safety in the workplace as well. So what we had to do is we had to start spanning this gap between leadership and the field. And that could only be done through dialogue. So what the leadership on their own came up with was employee engagement sessions. And we're in our fourth year now of employee engagement sessions, where leadership literally stops for a period of time. Every single person in the Forest Service will stop and engage around specific topics. The topics might be risk. They might be around personal resilience. Like Safety Engagement 3 was all done by the HP group, the Human Performance Group, and they set it up around personal resilience and personal resilience around employee wellness. And it gave people a real nice understanding in a dialogue-based engagement about how they might take over their own personal well-being. So it's kind of neat.
And the workers like this? I mean, they're into it?
Yeah, there's been mixed results. The first engagement sessions met a little bit of resistance because leadership was kind of feeling their way through it. Engagement 4 is going to start out with actually leadership saying that. We were feeling our way through, and we've kind of thought about this, and we want to turn more of this over to you. So they came up with 5 principles of what they thought safety meant, with a central piece called conservation, which is kind of neat when you think about it. It's more than just conservation of trees and conservation of the landmass that we manage. That's part of it, but it's also conservation of our people. And when they started thinking about conservation in that broader sense, they realized they needed to do something a little bit different in the engagement session. So this one, our group actually wrote it, IOL, the IOL part of my group actually wrote it, and they wrote it to start off with, hey, we understand as leaders, we started off with the best of intentions. We defined these 5 principles this way. And what we're learning now is that they can be redefined as we move on, as we learn more. And so what started out with something that was kind of static, almost like some people refer to the Moses' tablets,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
We've moved from there to, hey, we can question even the 5 principles in terms of what they mean. The principles themselves are sound, so we don't worry about that so much, but how we define them now, we define them as an organization, which speaks a lot to the idea of social construction and how things change as society changes.
How do you build this idea of curious leadership or leadership curiosity? I mean, I completely agree with you. The enemy of the question is always the answer. How do you sustain that systemically? How do you build that into your leadership expectations and processes and programs?
So this is like 3 questions.
Yeah,
it's not
kinda
bad.
No,
it's, but
I'm framing it in my mind.
Exactly, as you go. Let's start off with the whole piece about leaders becoming inquisitive. As leaders begin to inquire, as they have that idea around inquiry and the value of inquiry, then what you do is you just simply recognize that what they've been wanting to do all along is the right thing. They simply want the same thing that the field wants, When the chief comes out and he says, look, we want to strive towards zero fatalities. Well, everybody wants to strive towards zero fatalities. Who would want a different outcome? So what ends up happening is in essence a natural alignment of values in the organization, and that develops its own synergy, is what we found anyway. And so leaders are becoming more and more engaged around that synergy, more and more interested in keeping that energy going. And because they're more interested in keeping the energy going, they're more dialogic, they're more interactive with the field, and it just follows a natural pattern. So we don't have to keep it alive. It keeps itself alive.
Do they feel like they're losing control?
That's a great question.
It's got to be a part of that journey, at least.
In the beginning, there are lots of questions about control. You know, how are we going to do this? What is accountability? And those questions still surface from time to time. But what they're realizing is that the type of control that they exerted before was really not control.
Yeah, not at all.
No, you can't control anything. It's like information, right? All information is essentially voluntary,
yeah.
Right? So how do you control what you... Well, we'll make it a mandatory report. Well, the quality of the mandatory report is going to be completely a function of how much the individual wants to give information.
Yeah.
So as they realized that, as they started the dialogues, they started to realize that the more important thing was how they framed the questions. And then they started getting more information. And what they recognized, I think what they're recognizing, maybe they haven't all recognized it yet, but what they're recognizing is that now they have more influence. And the influence is more valuable than control.
I agree.
Yeah.
And it seems like this would really work in a private company.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they could move so quickly and not be burdened by the bureaucracy that is
I think private companies are probably a lot more agile. And so as they start to recognize this, they might even recognize it quicker than our folks did. And although I've got to say, our leadership, you know, it's kind of like the quote that was attributed to Mark Twain. When I went away to college, I thought my parents were the dumbest people on earth. I came back after 4 years and was surprised at how much they'd learned. You know, our leadership's kind of like that. I've watched this transformation in them, and they are really smart, really dedicated people, and they really want the best for the field. And if you've got that, how can you go wrong?
How do you sustain it? How do you sustain the curiosity?
Well, maybe we ought to talk about the bumps in the road, because that's fine. That's where we have to put more energy into the system to sustain it. So the bumps in the road are things like we had five fatality accidents last year. We had three fatality accidents that occurred in a week and a half period of time. And leadership was quite shaken by that. That definitely got their attention. So in a way, that sustains the energy, just having the fatality. I hate to say that there's a positive side to fatalities, but that might be it, right? And then we've instituted this new process through the IOL side of the learning review. And the learning review looks at things in terms of what is influencing the worker, not what is causal around the worker. And what we basically do is we develop two different reports, a technical report for the traditional stuff, because sometimes the traditional stuff is there and you can't disregard it.
Sure. But then any kind of mechanistic failure.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything that needs testing or understood. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, or if you wanted to do some sort of technologic improvement, or if there was a problem with technology, you want to recognize that. And that fits really nicely into the old form. And the way we kind of divide the world, because everybody likes to divide the world somehow, is simple and complicated lend themselves really well to traditional modeling, including, believe it or not, including the Swiss cheese model. That works in simple and complicated. But once you cross over the line into complex, the models seem to fall apart, and you've got to do something that's a lot more organic, and it's more dialogic-based. And so our learning review is that. We actually use focus groups of employees, focus groups of academic specialists, industry specialists. We've used a bunch of people who've been on the podcast, have been part of our investigations. We're doing our first co-investigation, if you will, not investigation, learning review, but co with the NTSB. We had a helicopter fatality that took place in DeSoto, Mississippi, and the NTSB is doing their traditional technical review, and we're doing a learning review alongside it. And we shared that with the NTSB, and they're like, yeah, we never would have looked at this stuff. This is great. And so they're getting kind of interested in it.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. And so it sounds like you divide events up into simple, complicated, and complex.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? Which is different than high, medium, low.
Mm-hmm.
Very different, because
very different.
Simple is simple, complicated is complicated, hard mm-hmm. to understand, and complex is many pieces tightly coupled, right?
Yeah.
That's a much better way to divide events.
Well, the thing that we realized, and we tried really hard
to... Who thought of that?
Me.
Okay, just checking.
Sorry. Yeah, that was actually my PhD dissertation was on this particular subject. Yeah, as it relates to organizational transformation.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But thanks for asking. That was good. where was I going with that? Back up a little bit. The learning review, if we start to take a look at that complex piece, what we started to do in the beginning, and I've got to say that it's been a learning journey as well, looking at how to do this thing. I mean, taken us 7 years to knit this thing together. But in the beginning, we kind of pushed really, really hard for the social because we had nothing that addressed social, and we neglected the technical. But what we realized is that there's a seductive piece of every single complex system, because every single complex system has elements that are complicated and elements that are simple. And if you're not careful, you'll get sucked right back into those. And that's why the technical report was so great. So we had an incident that took place on a forest in California where an individual was building a log corral, and they were using a pulley system, cable system, to move the log into place. And the log moved suddenly and actually ended up sadly killing this individual. But what we learned out of this incident is that there was a need to understand the mechanics of how that cable system was working, and a need to understand the social drivers that put that employee in a place that he thought was the right place to be.
Right.
Even though he discussed it, that wasn't his safety zone. He was out of his safety zone. And he was the expert actually writing the guide for the Forest Service on how to do this kind of cable rigging, writing the guide for us. And he was a volunteer. And he put himself in a position where the curve of the tree was such that the cable snapped the log into place and hit him, unfortunately, and killed him.
Because you don't think about dying building fence.
You don't.
I mean, if I was doing a risk ranking on that, it would be low.
Pretty low.
At every level.
Yeah, pretty low at every level. And so that's the other thing that we started to realize is that how the employee approaches risk is a function of how the employee perceives risk.
Are fatalities different than accidents?
I don't think fatalities or accidents are different than normal work except for the outcome.
Okay. I've just been thinking about this a lot. It strikes me that fatalities are outliers.
And
I think if we look at them as a logical conclusion to bad safety, kind of the Heinrich model,
that doesn't work.
That didn't work at all. No. But I don't know. I mean, a lot of people are spending an awful lot of time trying to tell me that they have a fatality serious injury prevention program that kind of reads like doing more harder. Like we're going to do more observations harder. We're going to write more procedures harder. We're going to do the same things, but we're going to do them harder than we've ever done them before. And it doesn't seem to work.
I think that if we're in that complex area, mm-hmm. right, what we're dealing with is we're dealing with a dynamic environment. In a dynamic environment, not all is predictable.
Right.
Trying to follow a policy or procedure when things are not fully predictable is challenging. You can't do it.
Yeah, it's not challenging. It's impossible.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's.
I guess
that's true.
Challenging.
Right? Yeah, it's super challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, way too challenging.
So what we've started to realize is that policies and procedures apply to certain things. That's the simple and complicated. That's where policies and procedures really, really apply. But what you may be picking up on with these other companies that you're talking with is that they're, again, seduced by that. That's the simple and complicated
piece. Totally. Yeah.
And that's the stuff that you can tell somebody to try harder, follow this procedure, because things are predictable in simple and complicated. But once you move into that complex place, what you want is the thinking employee. You want the worker who in that moment is making sense, is learning and improvising right in that moment.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, I think part of the reason I'm pulling the string on this is I don't think we've really framed the problem as a profession around fatalities. I mean, I don't even think, and by you reframing events into simple, complicated, complex, I mean, that's quite different, right? That may be the kind of thinking that we need to sort of engage around fatalities. Because I will tell you, super safe organizations kill people.
They do.
Right? Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure not safe organizations kill people too, although I don't have a lot of data on that. Fatality's probably not a failure of safety. It's really probably something much different. Like, I don't know. It strikes me that the safety people are really working hard to not kill people. It's a failure of almost operations.
Maybe the problem is in looking at it as a failure at all. So it might be refreshing to say, wait a minute, this isn't necessarily a failure. This is an outcome of normal work. You know, Holnagle talks about normal performance variability.
Right.
And he avoids the word failure by saying that.
Right.
He's tying that very much to the individual's performance variability and the system's performance variability.
And the resonance between the two.
Between the two. And so sometimes I think that safety programs have a tendency to look at, let's call them nodes, right? You look at the existence of things in the system, and you don't look at the interaction between them. It's really quite a bit more interesting to look at how the system nodes are interacting.
Right.
And that's really a presence of, not an absence of.
Right.
So not the holes in the Swiss cheese, but the existence of the communications between these nodes.
Yeah, so it's not a gap in the program. It's a complexity of the program.
The complex interactions of the program. And so in that way, it's not so much looking at an accident as an accident, but as this accident occurred and has brought us together to take a look at the system. But the learning review applies equally well to a non-accident.
Yeah,
which I think is even better.
Absolutely.
Because it opens up a whole bunch of things that there's a whole bunch of red tape around any kind of fatality. I mean, some are worse than others, but you have multiple agencies that come in with multiple different desires and needs and questions that have to be answered whenever there's a fatality. But when you've got what's termed normal work or a positive outcome event, none of that stuff exists. You've got free rein to look at the system and look at these interconnections. And that's where the real interesting opportunities are to prevent. So think about situational awareness. Everybody loves to talk about that. If we look at an employee and we're thinking about what situational awareness is for the employee, what we could really do is say, well, what if the employee was aware of when the conditions that they're working in were guiding their actions, as opposed to them recognizing the conditions and saying, okay, now I can be deliberative and make decisions in this space. Very different set of circumstances. I know this from my time as being an aviator. So I started flying professionally in 1985. And in aviation, we do this quite a lot. We try and recognize when the situation, the exterior forces on us or the conditions are such that the conditions are in control and we're in a reactive mode. That's dangerous in aviation. If you're in that situation, you're in the time wedge, we are trained to avoid that. So now look at firefighting. Firefighting for years in the Forest Service, we've been teaching people to work inside the time wedge. Well, it's exciting. You know, it's that whole thing rescuing things from the ashes. Yeah. And we love it, right?
Bambi. Come here, Bambi.
Yeah, and we're heroes at the end of it. But what we started thinking about organizationally is does that have the value that we want it to? And is working in that reactive mode where we want to be? We didn't learn that from fatalities or from failures. We learned that from successes. Because we like to work in that environment. We like to work in that time crunch. So that's the kind of influencing factors we want to get hold of, tying that back into situational awareness. If we literally work in a learning review to develop reports, what we're going to do is we're going to develop one for the organization, because the organization has that role in safety. And that role is usually around rules, regulations, policies, procedures, the things that they can influence. Right?
Gotcha.
How they position people in the organization, that's something else that leadership would like to know about from an accident. Are they putting people in the right positions? Are they providing them with the right tools, equipment, and training? Those are things that leadership needs to know. But the field has a very different need. The field needs to understand other things. What are the conditions that are prevalent inside the system? Because it's the alignment of those conditions that is going to result in either a positive outcome event or a negative outcome event. So what they need to do is they need to recognize those conditions as they're emerging. And so the tools that we put, the reports or products, we call them learning products. The learning products that we deliver to the field are around how do we recognize when things are moving to a point where the firefighter no longer has control and is more, the system has more control, the environment has more control because of the influences inside the environment. And so being able to recognize those conditions, those influences, that's the key to situational awareness.
Sounds good.
It's pretty cool, and it's working.
I mean, I like the focus away from the worker and towards the conditions.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like that's kind of good discussion. It's easily identifiable. I mean, you can – conditions are – they're easier to identify than situational awareness.
Yeah. And you and I have been talking about this for
a long time.
And
you don't do investigations.
No. We do learning reviews. And we call all of our responses organizational responses to incidents.
But if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck.
Well, I don't think it quacks like a duck anymore.
Okay, I'm curious.
I don't think it definitely doesn't quack like a duck anymore. Since we're not looking at causality, we're not making causal attribution. Unless it's in the technical report where we've got a failed mechanical component,
right,
that we can talk about cause. But when we talk about individuals, we're talking about influences. We're talking about influencing factors. We're trying to recognize the social implications of those influencing factors. What is that doing to them in the workplace? And then we try and split the road, like I said, between leadership in the field and focus on two products. How can leadership influence the system to create a better system? How can the worker recognize when the system's in control? It's a much different direction.
That's cool.
It's really fun, too.
And it works, right? I mean, you're...
Well, we haven't had any lawsuits as a result of it. Nobody's brought a lawsuit against the Forest Service for a fatality since this learning review process came out. We keep people informed throughout the process, including the people who were involved in the incident. So if we...
How do you manage the data?
It's great. I mean, first of all, we started thinking about witnesses as being... Well, all accident investigation courses tell you that witness statements are fundamentally unreliable, right?
Right.
But that's all we've got. But what the interesting thing about that is it's not so much that they're unreliable, it's that they are the perceptions of the individual. So if we can capture how the individual perceived that situation,
right,
and we can compare that to another individual's perception, we may be able to understand, remember the bridge between the nodes?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We'll be able to understand what that bridge between the nodes looks like. So if this person understood the system to be this way, and another person understood the system to be performing in a different way, and they never communicated, that might be important. That might be the important piece that we want to recognize. And then we don't admonish them. We simply say, what about this? And so in a dialogue, actually a field dialogue between our employees, we set a scenario, and the scenario could look like, what if the conversation went like this between these two? Would that have helped them understand the system better? Okay, if that's the case, then what can we do about the way we communicate with one another? And so we literally go into it asking questions. We literally want to ask more questions at the end of a report for the field or a field learning product. We want to ask more questions than we answer.
Yeah, well, I agree completely. Yeah.
And let the field do it, because the field will make sense of it. We have really smart people, really, really smart people. If we just give them the question, they'll go for it. Have we had resistance? Oh, sure. There's still a bunch of people who just want, give me the answer. Tell me what to do and what not to do.
Yeah, tell me what you want me to do, and I'll do it.
And I'll do it. But remember, if we're in a complex system, that what to do and what not to do will only apply to the accident that we just
right,
viewed.
Right, because it's so adaptive. Nice work, man.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
It's really fun.
Yeah, it's very cool. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, no sweat. Simple, complicated, and complex. It's a much different way to think about events, and actually all events, near misses, close calls, good catches, successes. Is it a simple problem? Is it a complicated problem? Is it a complex problem? It's something to chew on. I actually am going to experiment with it. I'll give you full reports as we progress through this thing and see what we think, but I have high hopes for it. I think it works better than high information, low information, because I think you can tell more about the case before it starts. It's a bit linear, or wants us to be a bit linear at least, but I think it's one to think about. This was an awfully good podcast. Special thanks to Pop and to everybody, but really, most thanks go to you. Thank you for listening. It means a lot. And you make the podcast go. There's no question about it. So until then, have some fun every day. Learn something new. I bet you did today. And for goodness sakes, be safe.